set up then next week. Let's have a word of prayer before we begin. Dear Heavenly Father, we're thankful for the privilege of being here today. We're thankful for your word and that you have preserved it for us and that we can receive what you have. We pray that you would speak, God, to our hearts from your word today. We pray for our pastor and each of the teachers and pray that everything done would be honoring to you. I pray in Christ's name. Amen. Last week in chapter 10, we kind of took off from verse 5 where it says, "There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler." And then the rest of this chapter goes on to describe the error that proceeds from that ruler. The error of mismanagement and corruption and all of the things that can go on in politics or in any leadership position that can bring you harm to that kingdom or to those under that leadership. In verse 8, he talks about digging a pit and then falling into the pit of his own making. He goes on to speak of tearing down a hedge. These are the hedgerows around their property, and inside those hedges, sometimes that's where the poisonous snakes would be hiding, and one of them would be released and then would bite. And the type of things that happen as a result of the mismanagement and as a result of the person in a leadership position being negligent and not carrying out and meeting their own responsibilities. He goes on then in verse 9, speaks of the one that is splitting wood, says that things can happen to him. At the best case scenario, it's going to make the work a lot harder because the axe is dull and he hasn't properly taken care of the tools and sharpened it. At a worst case scenario, that's going to cause him to be injured and great harm brought to himself as a result of what he's been, of his activities. And then he goes on, in verse 11, "Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and the babbler is no better." That we talked about the serpent being bitten, or the serpent biting the snake charmer because he doesn't properly do the job, because he doesn't properly deal with care and with finesse with that cobra that's with his head sticking out of the little box that has that stereotype picture in my head anyway of the snake charmer. But it says the babbler is no better. The one that deals in slander, the person that deals in gossip, is no better than that snake that comes out of that box and can bite and do great harm. He goes on then where we want to start our lesson today, and that was just kind of a rerun or kind of a introduction to where we're going today. But he says in verse 12, in verses 12 through 15, where he's going here, he's comparing the babbler, he's comparing that gossip, that slanderer, from verse 11, with the wise man. The speech of the fool and the speech of the wise man is what he's comparing. And so he goes into these four verses, and he starts in verse 12, "The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious." And out of these four verses, comparing the two, that's the only line about the words of the wise man. They're gracious. Enough said. End of sentence. Put a period there. That's all we need to know. The wise man's words are gracious. And then he goes on and describes the words of the foolish person. Now I want to compare this to Colossians 4:6. I'll read that here. Colossians 4:6, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man." What it's saying, let your speech be with grace. Who is the "your"? Who is he talking to? Who's Paul writing to in the book of Colossians? He's writing to Christians. Christians, our speech ought to be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how you ought to answer every man. But our speech is to be with grace. Now, take this back to chapter 10 of Ecclesiastes in this verse we just read. And I want to interpose or transpose or compose, I'm not sure what the correct word is here, but I want to put these two verses together. And what I would read in that, the words of a Christian ought to be always gracious. Then he goes on and he speaks to the rest of these four verses of what our speech should not be, we should not be speaking as the foolish person. We should be speaking as the wise person, and our words should always be gracious. And so let's think of that and keep that in mind as we look at how we should not speak in the rest of these verses. Beginning in the rest of verse 12, the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. In other words, the fool is just consumed with his own speech. He's just consumed with the sound of his own voice. You know, you hear some people on the radio and some talk show hosts, one in particular that I kind of like, but he's consumed with the sound of his own voice, and I think you probably already know who I'm talking about. He loves to hear the sound of his voice. I kind of like it too, but that's the idea of the fool. And as a Christian, we shouldn't be consumed with the sound of our own voice. We shouldn't be consumed with hearing ourselves talk. We should have a plan and a purpose in what we say and something that's worthwhile, not just talking to hear the sound of our own voice. He goes on then in verse 13. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness. The end of his talk is mischievous madness. What's that saying? Is from the beginning to the end, the foolish person's talk is idle and it's worthless and it's empty, it's meaningless. At the very beginning, his talk is foolishness, it's bragging, it's boasting, it's talking about things that really have no meaning and no value. And in the end, he goes from his bragging and boasting about all the wicked things he could do or all the things he knows how to do. You know, he could be bragging, well, I can hold my alcohol, so I can go out and drive when I've had a few and it doesn't really matter. Bragging about the things they can do. And what is the end of that? The end of that talk is mischievous madness. In other words, the end of that boasting and that bragging and that wicked talk is he puts it into action. Goes out and does the things that the fool has been bragging about and bragging that he can do. And so that's the kind of thing that the fool talks about. But what do we do back in verse 12? The words of a Christian should be gracious. The words of the Christian should be the complete opposite of that. So we need to be careful how we speak and how we use our tongues. Verse 14, a fool is also full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? The foolish person, just again, to hear the sound of his own voice, just can't stop talking. He has to interrupt, he has to interject, he has to give his opinion on any subject that comes up. And why? Because he just can't stop talking. He's consumed with himself. He's so full of himself that he wants to continually just ramble on. It says at the end of that verse, what shall be after him? Who can tell him? I remember hearing a saying, you can always tell a fool, you just can't tell him very much. And it seems to be the case that they always have their own idea and their own opinion, but we shouldn't be like that. The words of the Christian should be gracious. The words of the wise are gracious. He goes on then at the end of this, verse 15, the labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them because he knoweth not how to go to the city. The word there in that second line, of every one of them is referring back to the foolish. And so it's saying the foolish man's labor just wearies him because he has no plan. He has no purpose, which is what it means there, that he doesn't know how to go to the city. He doesn't know where he's going. He doesn't have direction. He's just floundering in the way that he goes. And I really want, again, just, I know I'm beating this dead horse, but this isn't how we should be. The words of the wise are to be gracious. All of these other 3.5 verses are telling us what we shouldn't be. And so let's remember that. We need to have our speech always with grace, seasoned with salt. It means it needs to preserve, it needs to add interest, it needs to have flavor, it needs to have value in what we say. Sometimes, you know, if you just can't improve on silence, maybe you shouldn't try. And that's something I have to to keep in mind, not just in teaching, that what I say has to be accurate, but all the time. I've got a big mouth. You all know me, and you know that I like to talk. And sometimes we say things that we shouldn't, but that's not the way that a Christian speech ought to be. We need to think. The saying goes, we need to engage our brain before we put our mouth in gear sometimes. And that's not always easy to do, but we need to think before we speak. But I think these are words to contrast the wise person or the Christian from the foolish speech that sometimes goes out of our mouth. We go on here in the rest of this chapter, and he's talked earlier about the foolishness of the king and the foolishness of the way we speak. Now he's putting these two together with the foolish and the things that the king may do or the leader may do. In verse 16, he says, "Woe to thee, O land." Woe. It means, alas, take note, pay attention to this. This is important. There's a warning coming. That's what the idea of woe means here. Woe to thee, O land, when thy child is a king and thy princes eat in the morning. Woe when thy child is a king. I don't know if it's speaking of chronological age as much as when your king is childish, when your king is immature, isn't ready for the job, and doesn't do the accept his responsibility and do what is supposed to be done. I think this is a proverb. It says that when it says woe to thee if your king is a child, it's a, like I say, a proverb. It's a general truth. It's not a hard and fast rule. And the reason I say that is if you think back to what is 2 Kings 22 and Josiah, he was one of the really good kings of Israel. And he became king when he was 8 years old. So the king can be a child, but I think if that happens, it tells me one thing. We know that his father was a wicked king. His grandfather Manasseh was a wicked king of Israel, and yet this little boy turned out all right. That tells me something about his mother. He had to have a godly mother that loved the Lord. If after generations of ancestors on his father's side were wicked kings, he did what was right. He learned that somewhere, and it had to be that he had a godly mother. I'm quite sure of that, and she probably directed him to godly advisors so that as he grew up and he matured, he did the right thing, and he tore down the idols of Israel, brought the nation back. But he had to have right upbringing to turn out that way. But as it says here, woe if the king is a child, if the king is immature and mismanages things, and who else? The princes eat in the morning. The princes would be the next level of leadership underneath the king. He would have, we would call it his cabinet, or his administrators that carry out the policies of the king. And what are they doing? They're eating in the morning. What does that mean? Look at the next verse. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles, and thy princes eat in the due season, for strength and not for drunkenness. The princes that were eating in the morning weren't eating to say, I'm going to have a good hearty breakfast so I can get out and I can put in a full day's work. No, they were eating in the morning because they liked to eat in the morning. They wanted to get drunk, as it says in the end of verse 17. He compares the ones that were eating in due season, were eating to gain strength so that they could work and do their job and do it properly, compared to those that were just getting up in the morning and having a beer and not doing their job, just partying, feasting, getting drunk, and frittering away the whole day and not paying attention to their responsibilities. Woe to the nation that has that kind of leadership in place, because what's going to happen? The nation is going to fall. If the nation has a king that's a son of nobles, or the one that is responsible, the one that has leadership skills, the one that applies those, the one that's diligent in meeting his responsibilities to the nation, that nation's going to be blessed. And so it speaks of that and of the danger of having leadership that's immature. And the immature leadership puts other people just like him in place. And so that's a great danger. Verse 18, it tells us what can happen when that takes place. By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness the hands the house droppeth through. When you have that kind of leadership, what happens to the nation? The nation collapses in upon itself. It's like the old house that gradually deteriorates and the roof rots and it gets water inside and the things fall apart, and eventually that old house just collapses into the basement. There's nothing left. How do nations, great nations, fall apart? They aren't usually attacked from the outside and overcome. They decay from inside. Certainly what happened to the Roman Empire, and I'm afraid that's what's happening to the United States. Just that rot from the inside. And that's what happens when you don't have the right kind of godly leadership that takes a nation where it ought to be. It collapses on itself. By much slothfulness, by laziness, by neglect, things decay. And it just collapses upon itself. And we see then in verse 19, a feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. I think that's a description of the princes that are getting up in the morning and getting drunk instead of taking charge and meeting their responsibilities. It's saying, a feast, let's get up, let's feast, let's enjoy the day, let's enjoy our party, let's not worry about the responsibilities that we have. Money answers all things. Boy, is that a quote for the 21st century. You know, as long as we got the money, as long as we can print a little bit more or borrow a little bit more, the party goes on. As long as nobody takes away the punch bowl, we're fine. That seems to me a great danger and a great warning for us, that the feast is made for laughter. That's the idea of the childish king and the drunken princes and the way they are going to lead a nation or a corporation or any organization that they're involved with. If they don't pay attention, if they're negligent, they're irresponsible in the way that they lead. We need to be careful in our own businesses, in our own families, in our own church, that these things don't creep in of negligence and mismanagement. We're careful of where we go and what we're doing for the Lord. In verse 20, curse not the king, know not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. Again, this is a warning. With all this going on, Solomon is warning the people about, be careful how you confront this type of thing that's going on in your nation. Now, fortunately, we live in a nation that we have opportunity and we have a means to legally and lawfully confront this kind of mismanagement and the things that are going on. But we need to be careful how it's done. I'm not sure if this last part of the verse, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, if that's where the phrase a little birdie told me came from, I'm not sure, but we hear that once in a while. Well, where'd you hear that? Well, a little birdie told me. We don't want to tell the source of our gossip, probably, where we got that. But we have to be careful how we confront things, how we deal with things. One more thing about these princes. There was a quote that I read, and I've used it and applied it to myself. These are people that live to eat rather than eat to live. And I sometimes apply that to myself because I do enjoy eating, and I enjoy probably more than I should. But I didn't realize how old this saying was. I thought that was something that just popped up recently. I found this quote in Matthew Henry's commentary, written in the early 1700s. So that one's been around a while. It kind of surprised me how long that had gone on. But we need to be very careful. We need to accept our responsibilities. We need to be diligent in carrying out the responsibilities and doing the things that we ought to be doing. Let's see if I can find the right page in my notes here. We go on now to chapter 11. We want to get this finished up. And it's, again, this is one of those difficult passages. I found a number of different commentaries, teaching, and they totally conflicting ideas. I picked the one that I like, and I think Of course, if they want to be wrong, they can, so I've got my idea. But anyway, take that for what it's worth. But we find here that there's real contrasting ideas of what chapter 11 means, and especially the first two verses. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Briefly, and just a quick summary, many people look at this, and I think it's been the traditional view, and I've heard it other places, that this is referring to charity. It's referring to generosity. Cast your bread upon the waters. Cast what you have. If you have a lot, cast it down so others can partake of that. Be generous in what comes your way. After many days, you'll find it. You don't know where it's coming back. You don't know if there'll be any return. But after a time, things will come back and they'll turn out all right. On the second verse, give a portion to seven and also to eight. Saying, well, if seven people need help, help them. If an eighth one comes along, if you can help them too. Just be very generous. Be very giving and very, to use a word I don't like, be very liberal in what you're giving. So, but I don't think that's what it's referring to. I think it really fits the better the context of the whole book. And especially down in verse 8, he says, all that cometh is vanity. He's still on the theme that everything is meaningless and empty. So I think this is just more of the idea, this is a better way to live so that you can continue on, and it's a better way in this life. It's still not going to be very great, but it's a little more tolerable than other ways that you can live. Now, casting your bread upon the waters is an ancient metaphor. And it's the idea of the grain trade and loading grain on ships, setting it to sail on the sea, and going around in the grain trade. And as you take this grain to different ports, you barter it for other products. And I believe that this is what it's talking about. We know Solomon was involved in that. We know in 2 Kings 22, I believe it is. Get ahead of myself here. In 2 Kings 22, that Solomon was involved in such as this, and said he sent out his ships, and they returned again in 3 years, and after 3 years, why, they had picked up gold and picked up silver and ivory and wild animals. There were peacocks and apes and things that were mentioned that came back to Solomon. And that's probably what this is referring to. He was involved in the grain trade, and he probably sent the ships out, and after 3 years, they went to different ports of call, traded some of the grain that was on the ship for the gold or for the silver, and they bartered it, and they sold it, and traded it. And after 3 years, it came back, and at the end of those 3 years, they found it after many days. They got the return for casting that and for shipping the products and for the trade that he was involved in. In verse 2, it's give a portion to seven and also to eight. In other words, it's what any good financial advisor is going to tell you today. Diversify your portfolio. Put a little in this mutual fund and a little more in that bond fund and something else in an ETF and something else maybe in a real estate or some other kind of investment. Spread the investments around. Sometimes things are going to go good in one area. Maybe the international funds will soar, or maybe they'll tank, but you don't want everything in one basket. I think that it was saying the same thing about Solomon. Don't put all of your grain in one ship or in one fleet of ships and send them all out at one time where one storm could sink the whole works. Spread your investments. Just be moderate. Be wise in your investing. Live the best that you can in this world. Make the best of it, because you don't know if anything is going to come back later. And so I think that's what it's referring to. He says then in verse 3, continuing the thought, if the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if the tree fall toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falleth, there it shall be. Storms come. Sometimes there are hurricanes. Sometimes there's floods and rain and hail and anything else that comes. These things can come. We don't have control over those things. Just use your common sense. Use some, be careful in how you invest and what you do. Just don't be so paralyzed that you can't get anything done. I remember years ago, and I can't remember, I think it was when we were building the feedlot rather than a few years later we built our house, but I was all wrapped up in reading what I should do and all this, and I just got so paranoid about all the things that could go wrong, and I saw an attorney about the mechanics lien and what can happen if somebody builds something for you and builds a product, but they don't pay the supplier, and all the secondary liens that can be placed on, and the hassle and the headache. And talking to that attorney, he said, I can draw up all kinds of paperwork and we can try to protect from every possible thing that can go wrong. But he said, the best advice I can give you is deal with local people. Deal with people that you know, people that have been in business for a while, and people that want to stay in business, because if they're shady, gossip gets around a town the size of Brookings, and especially the size of a town like Elkton, overnight, and they're going to be out of business. Just deal with the right kind of people. Don't worry about every possibility that can go wrong, because you're going to paralyze yourself and never get anything done. And I think that's what the advice here, what Solomon is saying. We don't know what's going to happen. Just be careful. Just be prudent. In verse 3, if the storms come, you don't know what direction the wind's going to blow. You don't know what direction the tree's going to fall, but you can't control that. Control the things you can control. Don't deal with things like that are out of your hands. Goes on into verse 4. He that observeth the wind shall not sow. He that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. You know, it's just part of farming. You know, am I going to plant corn this year? Rick, you going to plant corn? You don't know if it's going to rain. It might get dry. We might have a hailstorm. There might be some yellow kookaroo bug that comes in and we don't have an insecticide. Boy, what are we going to do? You become so paralyzed you do nothing. You know, if I worried about all of these things, I'd never pull the planter out of the shed. That's assuming I still had a shed and still had a planter, but that's another story for another day. But you'd be paralyzed. You'd never get anything done. And so do what you can. Be wise. Be prudent. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, but spread out the risk and just continue on. I know I've heard the saying, you don't have to be crazy to farm, but it helps. So we just keep that in mind. And sometimes we are a little crazy, but I've had people say, I could never do that. I could never take that risk. You put hundreds of thousands of dollars into the ground, and boy, you don't know if you're going to ever get anything back. And you can lay awake at night worrying about that. But these things are in God's hands, and we just have to put them aside. But there are some things we just can't control. And I think this advice is, again, this is advice of the natural man. This is the advice, the worldly advice, for someone that doesn't really know what's coming next and have any confidence in the Lord. So he goes on then, and we'll wrap this up in verse 5. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God who maketh all. So there are a lot of things we don't understand. We don't know what is the way of the Spirit. We don't know how the spirit of man enters into man at the time of conception. We don't know how that spirit departs and goes back to be with the Lord. This word, and I'm not even sure that's what this word is referring to. The word spirit here is the same word that's also translated as wind. It's an identical word in verse 4, he that observeth the wind. So maybe what this is saying is we don't know what makes the wind blow. We don't know what direction it's going to blow. We can especially 3,000 years ago, they didn't pull up their satellite photographs and understand the low pressures and the high pressure and the pressure gradients and how the wind blows and how the vortex moves and all that. I don't understand it either. These are just words to me. But we don't know all those things. We don't know how God works and how the wind blows. We don't know how the bones are formed in the womb. We know tremendously a lot more scientifically than they knew 3,000 years ago. But, and scientists will tell us, look at the way strands of DNA from two different cells come together to make one cell and one new individual and claim we have all this understanding, and the way those things come together determines how the bones are formed and how the organs are formed. And yet, see all that, and yet we know less than they knew 3,000 years ago, because we can't even recognize with all that we know about those things that with that kind of a design, there has to be a designer. And it's a fool's errand to try to think that out of some gigantic cosmic explosion 20 years ago, that tiny little baby is born today. With all of the nose and the eyes and the nerves and all of the organs and everything in place, that just happened by some cosmic explosion. Now, if there's a design, there has to be a designer. If you see a beautiful painting, you know there had to be a painter. It didn't just happen by dropping a few buckets of paint on a canvas. There was a designer. We have to remember that, and we really, in some ways, know less than they knew here. But we don't know those things. We don't know how God works. It says in verse 6, in the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand. Again, we don't know how these are going to work. We don't know, is it going to be better to plant early or should we plant a little later? Are we going to plant too early and the beans are going to freeze off or the corn's not going to germinate right? But if we plant too late, we've lost some sunlight and we've lost photosynthesis. And so what do? You spread the risk. I don't know of any farmer that plants one variety of corn says, this was really great last year, I'm going to plant my whole farm to that variety. That might end up that one variety all pollinates in that 3-day window in July when it's too hot and too dry for the pollen to properly pollinate the corn. No, we spread the risk, and that's what he's saying here. Sow some in the morning, sow some in the evening, sow at different times. Don't withhold sowing, don't withhold what you're doing. You don't know whether it's going to prosper. We don't know whether that early planted corn is going to be better than the late. Maybe they'll both be good. Maybe neither one will be good. But he's saying, in the eyes of the world, just spread your risk. You don't know how God's going to work. You can't count on anything else but how you work and how you do. So do the best job you can. And again, this is the book of man. It's the natural man giving advice to the natural man. And it's, as I studied this, and we see this theme throughout the book, live life to get the most out of it now, because you don't know what's coming. And as I've gone through this, I've spent most of my time in devotions back in the book of Psalms, because this book is so depressing. You know, and I started this in the book of thinking in the book of Romans of Paul, of who's going to deliver me from the body of this death of the carnal mindset. I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. But without that, this Solomon is right without that. If we don't have any hope in the Lord, if we don't have any certainty of what's coming, whether it be in this life or in the next life, life is depressing. Life is empty. Life is meaningless. Certainly, all you have to do is look at suicide rates and the billions of dollars in sales for antidepressants and all of the things that come with looking at life as just this life without any hope in the Lord. And so I've really gone into Psalms, and it's such a different perspective from between David and his son Solomon, of how God is in charge. God knows what he's doing. God has a plan. God has a purpose. And if we trust him and trust the fact that we know him, then we have that certainty, both in this life and in the future, that he's in charge. And life isn't that empty, meaningless thing that Solomon has portrayed here for this book. So we'll close that down today. Next week, we will conclude the book. And that will be the end of my teaching for some time. I was planning to continue on right